Welcome to another edition of the Entrepreneur Maestro Series, your source of insights and inspiration from successful entrepreneurs and advisors. Here you'll find cutting-edge ideas and age-old wisdom that will help you grow your business more quickly. This series was founded and is brought to you by veteran entrepreneur, speaker, and advisor, Paul Morin.
This is Paul Morin. I'm here with Robbie Klinger again, who has been gracious enough to come back. And last time we spoke about valuations. And this time we're going to speak about selling your company. And we're going to give you some, basically a flow of what the process of selling your company looks like. So thanks for being back, Robbie.
Thanks for having me again, Paul.
And I'm happy that we can have this opportunity to chat. You know, you and I in past lives have been involved in some of these deals together, so we have a strong familiarity with how the flow of an M&A deal works. So let's jump right into it. The first thing that has to occur in order for someone to be selling their company is that they have to make the decision to sell. So in your experience, what does that look like in real life?
This is probably the most difficult decision that many of these business owners are going to make. In many cases, these are folks that have worked for many years building their business, and it's sort of their child, like their child. And to part with it, it's a big emotional decision. It's a big, in times, financial decision, and it's a lifestyle decision. In many cases, what I've seen, it's not so much the folks are money hungry or anything of that nature. It's a lifestyle choice. It's that they get burned out. They've dedicated their lives to it, and it's time to step back and smell the roses and not have the daily grind of running their business, whether it's, you know, the small, you know, mainstream business, middle market business, whatever. The decision process is the same for all of them, and this can at times be the longest part of the whole M&A process. Is the owners actually coming to the point where they're ready to pull the trigger and say it's time to do something. I've seen instances where folks will call me up to have an initial conversation about possibly selling their business, and they say, well, you know, we're going to think about it. And then a couple of years later, they come back and say, okay, we're ready. It's not something that happens overnight. It's, you know, they think about it, they mull it over for a while, and when they're ready and they're ready to make that lifestyle change, that's when they'll pull the trigger and decide, let's start the wheels moving to try to achieve our exit strategy.
Right. Have you seen it where this issue, you know, given that the business basically becomes a part of this person, it's basically a part of their identity. It's like, as you said, like their baby. They've been nurturing it over many years. And have you seen where this aspect of the decision to sell, you can actually get many steps further in the process and then have this be the something that would actually kill the deal?
It in many cases can in fact do just that. The folks get so emotionally involved with their business, and it is like their child. And when you have an outside party coming in and, you know, assessing the business, which, you know, the outside party may have a different assessment than the folks that have started the business and run the business, sometimes the owners will find it insulting. They'll be very emotional about it, and it can kill the deal. The important thing is for the intermediary, their advisor in the transaction, is to try to mitigate any damage that the outside party might have if they say something that the business owner finds insulting. The intermediary should be really the one having the most interaction between the two parties and try to minimize any damage and help the business owner that's looking to sell understand that, you know, this is part of the process. They're not trying to insult you. Try to get over that emotional hurdle that can sometimes come down the line and kill the deal halfway through.
Right. No, I think it's a great point. And as you were talking there, it reminds me how big of a role ego can play in these deals. And, you know, as a business owner, I think you have to realize that, you know, your ego could get in the way. I mean, your ego is intricately involved or attached with this entity that you're thinking about selling. So it's not that you have to check your ego at the door, because most every great entrepreneur that I know has some ego, and that's been a big part of what's gotten them to where they are. It's just that you have to understand that, as Robbie said, you know, some of these things that may sound insulting from the buyer most likely are not intended to be such, and you just have to kind of take them for what they are and keep on moving. So on that note, the next piece of this and the next part of the process is for the business owner to understand the value. Now, we've done entire programs about this before, but can you give just a nutshell version to the folks listening about what it takes to understand the value of the company before you're putting it up for sale?
Well, this is where I usually end up being the bad guy for most of these business owners. I will come in and I will ask them for quite detailed information, financial information, background information on the company, management, et cetera, and develop a value for the business. Now, the process of valuing the business takes a look at the income and expenses, what the profitability is. You can look at comparable businesses that have been sold in the market area, the state, nationally, whatever the case might be, to develop a suggested fair market value, which fair market value, the term is defined as the price at which the property would change hands between a willing buyer and a willing seller. And the premise of that is that the buyer is a financial buyer, not a synergistic buyer, not a strategic buyer, someone that has additional incentive to acquire this business that they can leverage the synergies to their own business. We're looking at purely financial buyers, so it would be like you and I, Paul, going out to invest some funds into an operating business and get a return on that business. Many of the business owners, you know, because they've put so much time and sweat equity into this, believe their business is worth a lot more than what the market will bear. It's partly ego, the emotional aspect of it. They've spent years, in many cases, building this business, and they believe in their mind that it's worth, you know, X amount of dollars. And when you present this valuation that says, here are the facts, this is what it's worth, this is what the market suggests it's worth. Sometimes I get to be the bad guy, but you know, usually I try to sit down with the folks and help them understand why that's the case. And the value I come up with is, of course, a theoretical value. The price is something completely different. But two parties can negotiate a price that might be higher or lower than the fair market value valuation that I would come up with. But that's where the intermediary, the advisor to the business owner, comes in and helps broker the deal on perhaps more favorable terms than what the suggested valuation is.
Right. So, yeah, I know. I appreciate your insights there, because I can remember deals that I've been involved with, both in the United States and outside, where the buyer will get so attached to the value that we put in the valuation that becomes a deal breaker. The seller gets attached to that, and if a buyer comes in and wants to offer anything less than that number, then the seller just is offended by that simple action. And that becomes very difficult, and I think it's very important, as you said, for the intermediary to lay the groundwork that this is not a number written in stone. There's a great deal of assumptions that go into it. It's probably a great indicator of value, but the price that actually transpires when the transaction is done may be quite different.
And it's important also for the business owner, the seller, to realize that the valuation that someone like I would come up with as part of this process, the potential buyers don't usually see that valuation report. That's for the seller themselves to assess potential offers and future offers as they come in against what the theoretical fair market value actually is. And that's sometimes part of the problem in the transaction process is, as you said, you know, an offer will come in that's below that fair market value valuation number, and the seller will get offended. But oftentimes what they don't realize is that the buyer probably has never seen that valuation report and probably never will see that valuation report.
Right. So they're doing their valuation on based on their own model. They're doing their valuation, if they're a strategic buyer, they're doing their valuation with some synergies built in, and that might allow you to get beyond that fair market value. or if they're a financial buyer, they're looking to get the best deal. They have a fiduciary duty to their investors to get the best deal that they can in making these acquisitions and then growing them. So, yeah, I think the main point is that it's just nothing to take offense about, and you have to try to put yourself above any emotional aspect of what might be connected to the price of, quote, your baby.
Right. And it's the starting point. Once they've reached the decision to sell, it's the starting point for moving forward, because if you don't have an idea of what the business is worth, to solicit the business for sale to potential acquirers and not have some sort of, you know, value in mind, it just wouldn't make sense from a transactional perspective not to have some indication of value in mind. And I'd like to also point out that what happens in so many cases is, particularly with the smaller businesses, you'll have an advisor to the business owner, and it might be their accountant, it could be an attorney, it could be, you know, a business broker, telling them this is what the value is. And oftentimes, those advisors may be telling them what they believe the business owner wants to hear in terms of the valuation of the business, as opposed to what an independent third party providing that valuation that is not part of the transaction process would say the indication of value is.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. That makes perfect sense. All right, well, let's move on to the next step then in the process, which is to develop the deal book. Can you give a little background on what a deal book typically looks like?
The deal book is oftentimes also called a selling memorandum. And what that is if the intermediary is going to solicit the business to potential buyers. And usually we see this with middle market companies, the small mom and pop liquor store or bakery on the corner probably isn't going to have a deal book associated with it. But the selling memorandum, the deal book, has detailed information about the history of the business, perhaps employees, the management. It'll have some financial information in there to give potential buyers an idea of what the company is about, where they've been, where they're going, where they are right now, what the financial picture looks like. It's not likely to include the valuation, but it may include many components of the valuation that's been performed before in the financial analysis and how the business compares to the industry, the financial performance of the company itself historically and trends and any type of trend analysis. It'll give potential opportunities for the business. It may have a set of pro forma forecasted earnings included with the deal book. So it gives the buyer an overview to help them determine if there's sufficient interest on their part in possibly pursuing a transaction involving the company.
Right, okay. And what would be the typical length of a deal book? I know it would probably vary, could vary quite significantly, but what type of size of a document are we talking about here?
For a lot of the middle market companies that I've been involved in the transaction process, the deal book will range anywhere from 40 to 100 pages. It can be less. Usually the components are an executive summary. Then you'll get into the meat of it with the history, the operations of the business, the financial performance, past and present, and then some sort of projections and opportunities in the future. There might be a SWOT analysis included in there. But in general, it's probably in the 40 to 100 page range for your middle market companies, $20-30 million in revenues.
Right. Okay. That gives a good idea. On the next step here, which would be to identify potential acquirers, is that something that the intermediary would usually do based on their own network? Do they do a search? How is that usually accomplished?
Well, there's a couple of different ways they can do this. If the business that's being offered for sale is in an industry where there have been other acquisitions of similar businesses recently, the intermediary might reach out to those firms that have made acquisitions in the past, in the recent past, I should say. They may have the proclivity for another acquisition of the nature of the company that's being offered for sale. That's one aspect of identifying potential acquirers. Obviously, the intermediary can use their own network, and various intermediaries have different networks, some more substantial than others. They can search other databases of private equity groups, if it's something their private equity group might be interested in. General research on the internet of perhaps competitors that might be large enough and want to expand. So there's any number of ways that the intermediaries can find potential acquirers. Usually when you get into the middle market, you're not getting into a situation where they advertise or solicit in publications, though every now and then you will see in, you know, sections of the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times that there's a certain business, a nondescript description of the business that's available for sale for X amount of dollars, and for more information, contact so-and-so. That's one method. That's usually for much larger transactions. The smaller transactions probably aren't going to see that type of extensive advertising or marketing campaign. And then the real small business of the Main Street, you'll usually find those on business brokerage websites. There are plenty of those out there that business brokers or intermediaries subscribe to and then put listings on. It might be in local papers, et cetera.
Okay, so as yet, we haven't really given an indication of how long some of these things might take, and I think it would be useful to do that. So the decision to sell, that basically takes however long it takes, right? So you got to get that done before we move to the next steps. In terms of the valuation, how long would that usually take?
That can take anywhere from 2 weeks to 4 weeks or perhaps 2 months, depending upon the amount of information that the company has to offer to the business appraiser. In certainly larger instances, the business appraiser likes to visit the facilities, meet with management to get a better picture of the business itself, its operations, who's running the business, the future outlook of the business. So that can take anywhere, like I said, from 2 weeks to 8 weeks, depending on how quickly the business provides the information to the business appraiser.
On average, though, you'd probably say somewhere in the range of 2 weeks to a month, right?
Two to 4 weeks on average.
Okay.
Start to finish, from that initial contact with the business appraiser till they issue the final report. Typically, what I've done in the past is I will meet with management, review the information that's provided to me. There may be additional information that I need, which, depending on how timely a manner they get that to me, I will then prepare the report. I will send them a draft version of the report. Once they've had a chance to review that, I'll sit down with them and go through it in detail to help them understand how we arrived at the indication of value. Once they're comfortable with that, then I will issue a final report that they can then use and share with their intermediaries and other advisors.
Right. Okay. And in terms of developing the deal book, depending on the situation and what kind of time constraints there are, that's something that could actually be done in parallel with the valuation, correct? Or is it usually done sequentially?
It can be done in parallel or it can be done sequentially. If the intermediary, the advisory firm, is doing the valuation in-house, in all likelihood it will be done parallel to the valuation, because much of the information can be transported from the valuation to the deal book, the selling memorandum. If it's an outside party providing the business appraisal, the valuation, it may be done sequentially, and the advisory firm may use some of the information from the valuation. They may also be working on it simultaneously while the valuation is being performed by the outside firm. In any case, this is something that probably takes another two to 4 weeks on average, depending on, again, the flow of information and whether they're working in conjunction with the valuation professional or not.
Right, and identifying potential acquirers is something that the initial thrust of that can go a week or two, and then it's really an ongoing process, correct?
It is, and the deals that we've been involved with, and you can recall this, we began researching potential acquirers from that very initial contact with the seller when they decided, hey, we want to do something. And so the research on identifying potential acquirers was going on the whole time while the valuation was being performed, the deal book was being put together, and even beyond that. Because as you know, many of the acquirers may not have an interest, and you want to keep having an adequate source to ensure that you actually get a deal done. And it's always a process of finding more and more until you find the one that actually pulls the trigger and makes the acquisition.
Okay, so once you've identified the potential acquirers, the process then is to get them some kind of non-confidential summary, correct?
Correct. What we call a blind profile. And usually what that is a 1 to 2 page executive summary that doesn't give any identifiable information about the company. It may give, you know, a revenue size, a general description of what they do, but it won't usually provide any information that would allow the recipient of that profile to specifically identify which company it is that's being represented for sale. Confidentiality is obviously key, and you obviously don't want the whole world knowing that this business is for sale. If you know suppliers or customers find out about that, some of them may get apprehensive about doing business with the firm in the future, so it's key to maintain that confidentiality so that when the transaction is done, it's a seamless process and there's no disruption to the suppliers or the customers from the back of the house transaction.
Right. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So non-confidential summary goes out, and then based on the interest that these parties show, then they would, if they were actually going to receive the deal book, they would be asked to complete an NDA, correct?
Correct. The non-disclosure agreement, which is a legal agreement between the recipient of the information and the advisory firm and the client, that the recipient will not disclose any of the confidential information that's been provided to them to any other party outside their professional advisors. Again, it's the whole confidentiality issue. You don't want the whole world knowing the business of the seller. There may be trade secrets, proprietary information, obviously, that shouldn't be shared with other people. And oftentimes, what we've done in the past is we'll send both the blind profile, the non-confidential summary, and the NDA at the same time so that they can read it. If they have sufficient interest, they can fill out the NDA and get it back. And it helps sort of streamline the process so as to not prolong it any more than necessary.
Okay, so once they've completed the NDA, you send them the deal book, and they express an interest. The next step is to schedule a visit to the site. So what does that typically look like?
Well, the executive management of the potential acquirer, or if it's an individual buyer or private equity group, their advisors will schedule a site visit with the sellers of the company. And usually this is done in a way so as to not alarm employees or any of the staff. It's done very discreetly, just like a normal business meeting. Folks show up. The seller shows them the facilities. They may retire to the seller's office for a private conversation, more in-depth conversation about the business to get the feel whether they actually want to pursue additional dialogue regarding an acquisition with the seller. But again, it's done very discreetly so as to not alarm the staff or anyone that may be involved with the seller.
So if the potential buyer visits the site, they think they may be interested in putting an offer forward, they will do some very preliminary due diligence. And now people have heard the term due diligence over and over again, and it becomes a dirty word, I think, once you're on the receiving end of it, because, you know, some people I've heard it referred to as a cavity search. Not a nice term, but it can get a bit intrusive as you go through. And again, this gets back to the owner having to be willing to swallow a bit of ego and swallow a bit of pride and not overreact when a lot of questions are being asked. Because if you put yourself in the shoes of the potential acquirer, if you were looking to acquire this business, you'd want to get as much information as you could as well and make sure you're buying something that's worth the investment. But at this stage, we're in the early stage of due diligence. We're not in full due diligence. This would be the preliminary due diligence before there's any kind of letter of intent put forward. So what would be, in a normal circumstance, what would be covered in preliminary due diligence as opposed to the actual full due diligence? For now, let's just touch on the preliminary due diligence.
The information that's been shared in the deal book with regards to the financial information on the company is usually presented in some sort of a summary format. There usually is not detailed financial information. It's probably not the tax returns, not the audited financial statements, not any compiled statements, etc. It's likely in such a format that the advisor has created the tables to give an idea of what the revenues are, the cost of goods sold, your gross profit, operating expenses, and net profit. The preliminary due diligence, the acquirer will likely request the audited financial statements if they're available, or any type of compiled or reviewed statements from the seller's accountancy firm, to give a better idea of what exact expenses are, a breakdown of the cost of goods sold, for example. If the seller has multiple revenue sources from various products, they'll have a breakdown of the product revenues, the profitability of those products, each product line. You might have additional information as to who all of the owners are. If there are multiple owners, the acquirer may not have been privy to all of the capitalization table of the business and want to know who exactly owns what percentage of shares. They may want to see some preliminary corporate documents, structural documents. Any type of industry or market information that the seller has or is willing to make available to the potential buyer. And it may also involve additional in-depth discussions with the senior management of the selling firm. But it gives the acquirer some more detailed information to which they have previously not been privy in the analysis process.
Right.
And which could have an impact on their decision whether to pursue an acquisition of the firm.
Right. So at this point, it is important for them to do this, quote, preliminary due diligence, because we're beginning to a stage now where we're toward the end of the process where they will actually be putting forth a letter of intent. And all of these steps are very important, but I know in our experience, this whole letter of intent stage is extremely important. You know, if you put yourself again in the shoes of the buyer, you are basically stating your intent to purchase this company, or at least to put an offer forward. And it's these letters of intent are legally, they're not binding documents typically. Almost 100% of the time, they're not binding documents. But they do lay out a great deal of detail in how the buyer would look at doing this deal, so that it can be clear for the seller what this deal would look like, and they can decide whether they want to, you know, basically indicate there that, yeah, I'd be interested in doing that, and then they can move to the next stage. So, I covered a little bit of what's in the letter of intent, but could you go ahead and cover some of the other elements that you typically see in a letter of intent?
The letter of intent is sort of a roadmap as to the acquirer's intentions in going forward and acquiring this business. They'll say whether it's a stock purchase versus an asset purchase. They'll clearly identify that. What assets may or may not convey, any type of deposit or good faith money or earnest money. There may be a no shop provision whereby during the term of the letter of intent, the selling company will not go out and further solicit other offers. Those are some of the key aspects of the letter of intent. One of the important things for all the parties in this process to remember is the intermediary has to be very careful not to let counsel from both the seller and the buyer take over the process at this point. I've seen it happen so many times where counsel gets so hung up on details in the letter of intent, which is not a definitive agreement. It's not the closing documents. But they get so hung up in the details of that letter of intent that it can actually derail the deal. People will get frustrated. You'll have the seller and the buyer get frustrated, and the attorneys sort of take over the process and unknowingly and unwittingly at times kill the deal. And the intermediary in this process has to be very careful not to allow that to happen and maintain control of the flow of information back and forth, and help both parties, the seller and the buyer, understand what exactly the letter of intent is, the function, and how that letter of intent is going to provide the roadmap going forward so as to guide them in the rest of the process towards a successful closing.
Agreed. 100% agreed. And following up on one of your points there related to frustration, I think that, especially at this stage of the deal, that becomes one of the biggest risk factors in a deal just falling apart, because this process is grueling. And for those of us that have been involved with it a lot and are used to doing it, you become accustomed to it. You become accustomed to having it take over your life and to everything being deadline-oriented and to there being all kinds of urgency all the time, and it creates a huge amount of stress. And you remember, simultaneously, this business owner is trying to run their company. I mean, that's the asset that they're ultimately selling, so they can't let it be run into the ground. So we've seen it many times, and you know, your point about the attorneys kind of taking over at this stage is well taken. And even if they don't take over, just the sheer volume of requests, the sheer stress that's created by the grueling nature of this process can really push people over the edge and have them just walk away from what can be excellent deals. And we've seen it enough times that, you know, because of those type of issues, we've seen owners walk away from deals and then have situations change and have the economic situation in particular change greatly in the economy, and have that owner wish to themselves that they hadn't let themselves get kind of emotionally run over by the deal, and because they end up having to take offers that may not be quite as good. Because a lot of times at this stage, you know, you're in the early part of the dance, you're dealing with really the most highly indicated buyers, the most likely buyers usually, if you've done a good job of identifying them, and you don't want to have them walk away because of the frustration of the parties. So I think your points there are well taken, Robbie. And let's go on from the letter of intent to the actual full due diligence, which is maybe the most grueling aspect of the whole thing. Can you talk a little bit about what a typical due diligence entails?
This is usually the part of the process where the acquirer gets really in-depth with the company that they're buying. It may involve having their own accounting team or financial analysis team come in and work with the sellers to go over the books, get more detailed information, perhaps ad nauseum detailed information regarding accounts receivables, contractual information if there are contracts with suppliers or customers, all specific information that hasn't been made available in the past. But subsequent to the issuance of a letter of intent, the acquirer now is really, this is the heavy duty stuff here. This is the make or break. They want to get in there. The devil is in the detail, as the old saying goes. They want to know all of the details about the company, find out if there are any perhaps contingent liabilities or any skeletons in the closet, and really get in there and understand the business more in depth. It might be at this point where there are additional meetings with not the executive management, but senior management, lower level management. If you have a strong management hierarchy in the organization, they might have interviews with employees, et cetera. And at this point, people are going to know that something's going on. And it's the intermediary's function as well to help the seller and the buyer not get frustrated in the process, keep emotions out of it, and keep the process moving along. Because, again, the deal can get killed if you get counsel, accountants, advisors involved, and try to take control of the process and the due diligence process. So this is really where the advisor needs to help step in. The intermediary needs to step in and help get all the information that the acquirer needs, help arrange and coordinate site visits, the flow of information between the parties, etc.
Okay, right. I agree. I think that due diligence is one of the most risky parts of the whole process, and we've seen plenty of deals blow up there, and that can be frustrating all the way around because all parties have put a huge amount of effort in blood, sweat, and tears into making the deal happen, and to have it, you know, essentially have the ball get intercepted, to use a football metaphor, at the 1 yard line, is frustrating for everyone, and it carries its risks as well, because if this is the best indicated buyer, you don't want to have something unnecessary blow the deal up. So Okay, so that's due diligence, and we're pretty much there. If we get through due diligence and everyone's happy and the adjustments are made to the deal, we can get to some final documents here and the closing of the deal. Can you talk about what some of the most important agreements are on that closing and what the closing typically looks like?
Well, this is the part where there's no avoiding the attorneys being involved. And again, it's up to the intermediary to help maintain the flow of information and keep this process moving along, because you know, attorneys can tie this up for length of time where the parties get frustrated and pull the plug. So it's very important to keep the process moving. The closing documents are going to be legal documents, usually the purchase agreement, which is guided by the letter of intent that states, you know, we're going to pay the seller X amount. This is how we're going to do it, cash, stock, note, etc. It outlines everything that the acquirer has indicated they're going to do and that has been negotiated by the intermediary and the seller with reference to the letter of intent. Any type of debt assumption, earnouts, consulting agreements for the seller, employment contracts for any employees, compensation payments, whether the real estate's going to be acquired, if there is real estate, or if it's going to be leased from the seller, all of those are important parts of the purchase agreement and consulting agreements, etc. You'll have the representations and warranties. That's also a crucial part that may outline the seller's responsibilities should anything that had not been anticipated come up once the acquirer takes control for a certain period of time after the acquisition. Those are pretty much the key parts of the closing documents. And then, of course, you have the actual closing, and it's usually not a process where everyone gets around a table and signs papers at the same time. You'll have an acquirer off somewhere else, and they'll do it at their attorney's office, and the papers will be overnighted back and forth, and you'll integrate the new management into the old company, the acquired company, if that's the case. This is all part of the closing and post-closing process, and again, it's the intermediary's job to help move this along in an efficient manner and not let it get hung up on small details and try to help guide the parties to a successful closing.
Yes, and I think that that's a great summary of the closing, and I just want to add a couple of nuances to that, which we've seen a lot, and just so that any potential, you know, business owner out there selling their company is not taken by surprise. Related with the reps and warranties, you will typically have an escrow. You're going to, a certain amount of the deal proceeds are going to go into escrow, and they're going to sit there for a certain amount of time until the reps and warranties that you've made as a seller can be essentially proved out. And that, I know, is often a very contentious point for the sellers, because they're looking to have their money right then and there. I mean, they'd like to get this deal done and be done with it, and that's just typically not how it works, because there are enough uncertainties in the deal for the buyer that they're going to make you or ask you to make reps and warranties. The other aspect I think that's important to prepare the seller to understand is that there will typically, in these deals, as part of the consideration, there will be an earnout, what's called an earnout aspect. And you, again, will not be getting all the money up front, usually. It's sometimes you will. But there will be a period of time during which, based on the performance of the entity once it's acquired, you will receive what's called an earnout. And that can take several different forms. But in essence, what it equates to is that you will get more money, assuming that the entity performs up to the expectations. And related to that is that usually you won't just sign the deal and walk away. It happens sometimes, but usually the acquirer will want you to stay, because a lot of this business has been built on your back, and a lot of the success of this business is based on relationships that you've created over time. So you have a vested interest as well, based on the earnout, to hang around for a bit. You'll usually get a consulting contract that allows you to stay around and help the buyer have a smooth transition and help them do the integration that they're trying to do. It's not always that way, but very often it is, and as a seller, you need to be prepared for that. So
yeah, one of the common misconceptions that many sellers have is that it's like selling a house. Closing, you get your money and hand over the keys and you wash your hands of it, when in all actuality, it's far from that. There's going to be additional periods of time following the transaction, the post-closing, the integration period, where they're going to be an integral part of helping integrate the new owners into this business and helping, you know, manage the relationships with the customers and the suppliers and the employees. And you made a great point that, you know, these owners have built this business on their name, their reputation, and their relationships with many different parties. And you can't just suddenly take them out of the picture. They're going to be involved post-transaction for some, you know, predetermined amount of time, and perhaps then some, to make sure that the transaction is successful. Because in most cases, as you said, the seller doesn't get a check for everything and walk away. There's usually some sort of form of payment tied to the future performance of the company to help ensure that the seller wants to see the business succeed so that they can get their payments over time.
Correct. Yeah, that helps to align the interests, you know, and as the buyer of the company, you're wanting to have everybody's interests aligned so that you don't buy something and then by virtue of the seller leaving, have it just all fall apart and not be exactly what you thought you were buying. So, well, Robbie, once again, thank you. Great insights. If you could please tell the folks how they could get a hold of you if they'd wanted to.
They can reach me via the Highland Global website. It's www.highlandglobal.com. There are links there to direct email addresses, phone information. They can reach me that way. My direct email address is corporate@highlandglobal.com. They can send any inquiries or additional requests for information to that, and we'll try to respond in as timely manner as possible.
And Highland is H-I-G-H-L-A-N-D, correct?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. Well, hey, thanks again. Great talking with you, and look forward to doing this again sometime soon.
Well, thanks again, Paul. Appreciate it.
All right, Robbie. Take care.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the Entrepreneur Maestro Series, your source of insights and inspiration from successful entrepreneurs and advisors. If you're not already a subscriber, go to EntrepreneurMaestros.com and subscribe. Also, visit the Company Founder blog at CompanyFounder.com for more great entrepreneurial insights, tools, and connections.